I'm Brittany Luce, and welcome to Sampler, the show where we play you handpicked moments from podcasts that you just have to hear. We just want to let you know that we are going to talk about adult themes today, and we will have adult language. So this may be the time to put your earbuds in or send your kids out. So today on our show, we are talking with Anna Sale. Anna hosts the WNYC podcast, Death, Sex, and Money. Hi, Anna. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Brittany. I'm so glad to be here.
I'm so glad that you were able to come. So ever since we have started Sampler, I wanted to have you, Anna, on the show. I mean, I'm a super fan of your show, but specifically because I think that you were like one of my favorite interviewers of all time.
Thank you.
Anna likes to say that the show is about the big questions and hard choices that are often left out of polite conversation. So you can see why we had the... Not suitable for children warning. But you managed to talk about things as heavy as death and sex and money without ever having it be like tawdry or sensationalistic. I mean, death, sex, and money is like that's 90% of the covers of Us Weekly. You know what I mean?
Which I love.
Yeah, which I absolutely love. But your show never feels like you're gawking. It feels like you're gently probing, but sometimes the questions that you ask are like, you are not shy.
A lot of contradictions, right?
So today, in honor of your show, Anna, we are going to play you a death clip, a sex clip, and a money clip, but necessarily in that order.
Okay.
It's going to be even more surprising then.
I might think it's the money clip, and it's really about death.
Yes, but our first clip that we're going to play is actually from your show, just to give listeners an idea of the kinds of conversations that you have. It's from your interview with sex columnist Dan Savage.
Oh, I love this interview.
Dan is the host of a podcast called The Savage Lovecast. In this clip and on the show, you guys talked about monogamy. He was saying that monogamy is not necessarily a requirement for a relationship or even beneficial to a relationship. And then after he asserts this point, you do something really interesting, something I'd never heard you do before. You asked him if there was anything that he wanted to know about you.
Are you in a committed relationship?
I am.
Are you not monogamous?
No, we're monogamous, yes.
So what would you do if you found out that he cheated? And what do you think he would do if he found out that you cheated? And cheating is something that will probably happen.
Like, yeah.
Just put that out there first. The research and the data shows that roughly 50% of men, 50% of women in long-term relationships at some point will cheat. And those 50% of men are not married to those 50% of women. So it will touch almost all committed monogamous relationship. So what's going to be your reaction if and when that happens to you?
I know. I mean, I read you, Dan Savage, and you make me uncomfortable because I intellectually, I understand all this. I get desire. I get that it's not rational and I get that it's a real thing. But I don't know what I would do with the hurt. I have a really difficult time seeing a way outside of it being okay. Or seeing a way for it to be okay.
My advice would be, if and when it happens, you know what people always say when they talk about the people they love most in their lives? I would take a bullet for this person. I would, walk through fire for this person. That's hurt. You're saying I would hurt for this person in a really profound and life-threatening way. I would take a bullet. I would walk through fire. Infidelity, when people believe in monogamy and monogamy is what they want, infidelity is that bullet. And so if you look at your husband and think, I could take a bullet for that man.
We're not married yet. I'm not even there.
Or if you look at your, if you look at your partner and think, this is someone, I love you so much, I could take a bullet for you. Just if and when it happens, remember that feeling because that's the moment where you take the bullet. And some people accuse me because I'm pro, non-monogamy, that I'm, giving get-out-of-jail-free cards to serial adulterers, and I'm not. People should honor the commitments that they make. If you make a monogamous commitment, you should attempt to keep it, attempt to honor it, do your best. And then if you, if it happens to you, if you get cheated on, what is love and what is forgiveness if you can't forgive the person you claim to love most in the world for a betrayal that really cuts you to the core? And I think these things should be, because infidelity is so common, These things should be thought about well in advance of them happening. Because I think if you just set your mind to that is something, as painful it is, that we can get through, love each other through, forgive each other for, you're likelier to actually get through it, love each other through it, and forgive each other for it when it happens, if it happens.
Dan Savage, thank you so much for your time.
My pleasure.
That's all I'm going to say. I'm not going to say any more about whether I'm going to be able to handle it if my boyfriend cheats on me. I'm going to leave it there.
Or if you cheat on him.
Or if I cheat on him. It's true.
Women cheat too.
Makes me uncomfortable all over again.
You say it makes you uncomfortable?
Yeah.
How did you feel in that moment?
Because I've heard Dan Savage talk a lot about the importance of exploring and being honest about monogamy and its constraints in relationships. And like I said to him, you know, you get it when you're thinking about it from an intellectual level. And then when the conversation became like, what would happen in your relationship mm-hmm. should one of you cheat? Like, it just becomes that, it's just much more raw to experience that conversation when you're actually thinking about it in those terms of if there is a betrayal or a violation, you know, that we have to mm-hmm. encounter.
You guys even got on that topic only because you asked him, do you have anything, you know, that you want to ask me? Is there anything that you want to know about me? Why did you do that? That's like my greatest fear, is like being interviewed. It's kind of terrifying.
It's something I ask people a lot now at the end of interviews. Mm-hmm. That was the first time I had asked it. And thinking back, it makes a lot of sense that it was to ask Dan Savage that, because his job is to, you know, give advice to people. So he's always quickly assessing the dynamics of, you know, what's going on in the person's life that he's engaging with. Mm-hmm. So, and also he has his things that he are his core messages. So he is in some ways, you know, rehearsed on some things. So mm-hmm. I knew that asking him that would sort of throw it off, throw off our conversation, and mm-hmm. it might get to an interesting moment. And it really did.
Yeah.
And of course, if Dan Savage is going to ask me one question, it's like, what's the deal in your bedroom? You know, I should have expected that, but I didn't somehow. And so, but we got so many emails after that moment on the show, because it to think about whether cheating in a relationship is taking a bullet for your partner, being mm-hmm. willing to love your partner through that betrayal is a good way to think of it or not. People had, you know, varying opinions, but I think just to hear someone openly acknowledge that people get cheated on and people cheat was refreshing.
Why do you think refreshing?
Because when you're cheated on or when you're cheating, it's completely isolating because there's so much shame. Mm-hmm. And we did an episode last year that was around that. We just asked people to tell us their cheating stories.
Ooh, I remember
and it was
that.
And it was like, you know, you just sort of opened the can and people needed to share mm-hmm. because think about it. If you're a partner of multiple years who everyone knows you as a couple and then you find out that he or she is having a, you know, tawdry affair on the side, it's humiliating.
Yeah.
You're not going to talk about that.
Yeah.
But there's so much you have to process and that you feel alone in. And mm-hmm. I think That's what I really like about podcasts is like, and in particular, what I was trying to do with Death, Sex, and Money is that it can be a place where you can like let yourself access those emotions, and you don't have to, you know, it's such an intimate setting that mm-hmm. It gives you a little bit of space that wasn't there before to maybe process some of that stuff.
Sorry, I just had to raise my eyebrows. God, but that was. I guess this is why you're Anna Sale and this is why you host Death, Sex, and Money. So that brings us to our next clip. It's either a death clip, a sex clip, or a money clip. But this clip is from a podcast called First Time, Last Time. So it's mm-hmm. created by this guy, Ben Adair, and it's all about people talking about the first time that they did something and the last time that they did the same thing. In this episode, an author named Joe Loya is talking about a big decision that he made moving from life as a petty criminal onto something much, much grander.
I was committed to the idea that I was a new man, new life. Fuck it, I'm going to go rob a bank. So I drive up to the United States, and I go to downtown San Diego, and I start walking in and out of banks. And I walk to the first bank at 10 o'clock in the morning. I stand there and I grab a deposit slip, and on the back of it with a marker I write, "We have a bomb. I have a gun. Give me the money now." And as I finish writing it, I look up and I panic and I walk out. It turns out for the rest of the day, I'm walking in and out of banks, and I'm leaving in various stages of distress. I'd stand in line for 2 seconds and then leave. I'd go to the front of the line, "Sir, you're next." I'd leave. I would just like, I would walk in, I would get a hint that there was a guard around there or something, I'd leave. And so at 4:45, I'm like, fuck, I can't go back. If I don't do it today, I'm a lame, I'll never rob a bank. If I want to be a bank robber, here it is, man. You got to fucking shit or get out the pot. And it's 4:45, it's deadline time. So I walk in this bank, I got my shitty little note, and I walk up to this woman, tell her. She said, "Hey, how you doing, sir?" I said, "Oh, fine." And when I walk up to her, I put the note there, and I slide it toward her. Now, she looks down. I mean, I'm not an asshole. You got to give her a little time to read it, right? she reads it, and I realize, oh, you know what? She probably got stuck on one of the words, and she, you know, she's reading, taking a little time to read this. Now she could have read it twice. Hey, wait, now she's just fucking with me. She's not lifting up her head. So I start, like, and I lean forward. I'm not fucking around. And I kind of, like, move the note, slide it around a little bit. Like, hey, man, fuck, pay attention to me. Look up. And then she pulls the note and pulls it towards her. And I'm like, fuck, give me my note back. Like, I slide it back. She pulls back. And now we're doing a tug of war with a fucking note. And she still refuses to look up. And she lifts her head and looks at me and starts handing me money. And as soon as I hit the door, boom, I start running. When I was that age, I was thin and lean and fast as fuck, broke school records and track. So I hit the streets running fast as fuck, and I look back, and there, I'm being chased now. People in the bank are chasing me, like they're after me, and I'm just making space, you know, I'm just making space between us. I get over to a cab a couple blocks away, jump in it. I'm all excited, fucking $4,300 for nothing. Basically, the work itself, less than 10 minutes. Fuck robbing, stealing cars. Fuck, like, bounce checks. I know what I'm going to be. I'm not going to be petty. I'm now going to be a bank robber.
Can you guess what kind of clip that was?
I think that was the money one.
I think you're right.
And my favorite is, if I don't do this today, I'm never going to be a bank robber. Go time.
Exactly. It's like it's all or nothing. It's all or nothing.
Yeah.
But actually, speaking of money, I guess like the money that you specifically talk about on your show. So I think that like death and sex are topics that people regularly know how to like engage with up to a certain point and kind of disengage. And they're also topics that I think that people find more unavoidable. I find the money conversations actually on your show to be the most surprising.
Mm-hmm.
Why do you think it is that people are so weird about money or so hesitant to talk about it, I guess, like in polite
in life?
Conversation? Yeah, in life in general.
Yeah.
Because people are even, it's like people will talk about sex with their partners. They'll talk about death with their family members or with their children. But people will not talk about money with anyone sometimes.
Yeah. I think it starts with that we don't really know how, because there's just not a common language. Thinking about sex, if you share a peer group with people, you know, you kind of can assume that, you know, there's certain values that you share, like things like, you know, consensual sex is important.
Yeah.
You know, desire is something that both women and men have.
Yeah.
You know, it's so, like, but around money, it's like we talk about it so little that we don't have any, like, there's no prompts really. And I think it's from a few things. Like, first, like, you never know where you stand with the person you're talking with.
Mm-hmm.
You could have much more money and be much more comfortable in the world as a result and not have that existential dread that you're not safe in the world. Mm-hmm. That can happen when you don't feel like you have enough money. You might have shame about having money. So I think that's like the baseline. And then I think it's so interesting. And to have a conversation where you're like, acknowledging that there's something deeper about those choices than just like trying to follow, you know, Susie Orman's personal finance advice, you know, I think is interesting because there's a lot of decisions we make about what we think about how our life is going to go that you can get to when you ask about money.
Yeah. Money's emotional. That's something that I'm finding the older that I get, is that like money is extremely emotional.
Yeah. And it's like emotional, and it's also like, it's also so black and white and cut and dry. It's like, there is this amount of money in my checking account right now, but I have so many feelings about it. And the way I feel about it today is different than I felt last night in the middle of the night when I was worrying about X or Y, you know?
Yeah.
I find that kind of interesting.
I'm glad that you asked about it. I'm glad that you enjoyed our money clip.
Yeah, it's good. It's really good.
So we're going to actually take a quick break right now. But first, to recap the clip so far, Dan Savage on cheating came from Anna's own show, Death, Sex, and Money. And the bank robbery is from the podcast First Time, Last Time. Coming up, we've already covered money, so let's talk about sex and death. You like that?
Yeah. Stay after the break for the sex. Just stay for the sex. Yeah.
Welcome back to Sampler. My guest today is Anna Sale, host of WNYC's podcast, Death, Sex, and Money. And in honor of Anna, our clips today all follow the theme of her show. So we've already gotten the money out of the way. We've done the hard thing first. So Anna, this next clip is actually from something that you recommended. So we asked you to send us a podcast episode that you liked, which we usually ask our guests for to kind of like figure out what they're listening to know what it is that they're into. And it helps us inform what clips we think might be good for you to hear. So you brought us an episode from Fresh Air with Terry Gross, which is an NPR interview show and also a podcast. This interview is with Tim Gunn, who is best known for his role as a mentor on Project Runway. What was it about this interview that you enjoyed so much?
I can remember exactly where I was listening to it. I was on the subway. The way it started was very charming. Like Terry, who doesn't make interviews about her, they started by exchanging information about what they were each wearing because they weren't in the same studio. It's just like, you know, her first question, what are you wearing? And he was wearing something very, you know, classic and put together. And then she described her outfit and they talked about pleather versus vegan leather.
Oh,
and
it
just
part.
Was very, I just really liked it. I liked that it was like, it was a surprising open. And then very quickly it became a conversation about who Tim Gunn was before he was Tim Gunn on television, including his really severe depression when he was a teenager. And then it became a conversation about how he felt like he got well. And he talked really lovingly about his macho dad, his dad who was a speechwriter for J. Edgar Hoover. Like, just like so much interesting stuff packed in, but it was all about basically Tim Gunn learning how he wasn't alone in the world.
We have chosen a clip from that episode. Terry Gross asks Tim Gunn about how he attempted suicide when he was a teenager, which he had talked about in an It Gets Better YouTube video. So he starts off by explaining to Terry what tipped him over the edge.
I had been dropped off at yet another boarding school by my parents. And it was that first night. I had taken, I don't even know how many prescription medications out of my parents' medicine chest, and I didn't even know what they were. I mean, I knew they were prescription, but I didn't know what they were. And I took all of them, probably easily 100 pills, and I was so resigned to just going to sleep and not waking up. And that next morning, I did wake up, and I was completely disoriented. The room was spinning. I couldn't believe I was still alive. And my disorientation didn't get better. So I went to the school administrators and told them what I had done. And then, of course, they brought in a doctor. And in spite of the fact that I was still there, they took my blood, pumped my stomach. There was still stuff in it. Anyway, it's a long-winded way of saying, yes, there was a catalyst. It was that I was being dropped off at another school. I had no reason to believe that that experience was going to be any better than anything else that I had gone through. And I thought, I don't like this life. This is really rotten, and I want to just stop it. So my father took me to the hospital, and what I didn't expect was that I'd spend the next 2.5 years there.
We're in the hospital?
Mm-hmm. Yes, I haven't. Don't know that I've said that to anyone.
Wow.
I mean, more precisely, 2 years and 4 months. So I had a very major intervention there and couldn't run away, or I would have.
Was that considered like rehab? Was it like a rehab setting, or was it
a psychiatric hospital for adolescents.
Was it the right thing to do, you think?
Yes, it saved my life. And the doctor I had there, and he was actually my third doctor because I was a very difficult patient. And doctors would, I won't say give up on me, but they'd pass after about 3 months. And Dr. Philip Goldblatt, God bless him, wouldn't let go. I saw him 5 days a week for almost 2 years.
What made doctors give up on you before that, do you think?
They would lose patience. I mean, I will say this about myself. I'm smart and I'm canny. I figure things out quickly. And I knew how to manipulate and maneuver around them. And I knew how to simply be intractable and difficult. And for Dr. Goldblatt, I mean, our first couple of months together, he was with me almost all day, every day. And it was a matter of, guess what? You can't escape me, and if you want to keep playing these games, I'm here to say, okay, play them. I'm going to watch it all happen, but I'm not leaving. And I didn't believe him, and I tried to push all of his buttons so that he would reject me, and he wouldn't stand for it. And I love that man. In fact, I tear up when I think about him and what he did for me.
Do you think about him when you're mentoring people?
I do.
You mentioned that you liked this interview because it was learning about this public figure, I guess the journey that he went on to feel like he wasn't alone in the world, as you put it. And he had talked about the suicide story before, but that particular detail, the hospitalization, he hadn't mentioned it before he talked to Terry Gross. And I find that when I listen to your show, that people have the same sorts of reactions, like the same sorts of, you know, like, I didn't know that I was going to say this, or I didn't know we were going to talk about this, or people get choked up, or people pause. What do you think it is? Like, what do you think happens in the guest's mind? Or what do you think is happening with the guest emotionally that gets them to the point where they share something that they genuinely haven't before?
So that clip that you just played with Terry, how she asked the question after learning that it was more than 2 years in a mental hospital, she said, do you think that was the right thing to do? Like, it was such a gentle way to say, how do you feel about that time? Do you feel like you were, locked up? Do you feel like you needed it? Mm-hmm. Do you feel resentful? Do you feel glad? And it's that kind of question that then he gets to say, here's how I feel about my life. And you can tell she's really listening. And so I think that there's something around... there's just something that happens when you feel like you're being really listened to, and when someone really wants to not only sort of understand exactly what you're saying, but like understand the details of that moment. Like, well, where were you living? How old were you? What was going on? And so then they kind of go back to that moment, and they start narrating it in a way that brings in more details than maybe if they told the same story at a dinner party. Mm. But I think it begins and ends with that feeling of a surprise that someone is actually listening carefully to you.
Often on your show, people tell you these really surprising stories. Even when it seems like you've probably done some pre-interviewing, obviously to find out certain details, to know kind of what to move toward, still you'll actually get into the conversation. And they say something that obviously surprises them that they've told you, but also sometimes you seem surprised. What's the most surprising thing? Not necessarily shocking, but what's the most surprising thing that a guest has told you?
The thing that immediately comes to mind, because it's one of my favorite moments on the show, because I didn't know this was where we were going, but I was talking to Dominique Foxworth, who is...
Former
NFL player, now a graduate of Harvard Business School. I was asking him about the dynamic on campus when you're 18, 19, a freshman, you're already kind of a star on campus when you show up right out of high school because you're a college football player at a big college football school. Mm-hmm. And I asked him what it was like with women, thinking it would be like, oh, yeah, you know, here's some story, you know, because you sort of, you know, you kind of know what that experience is uh-huh. like, but you don't often hear it narrated. And he brought in this dimension to the conversation that I hadn't really thought about. And he was like, you know, yeah, you know, I treated, you know, women not as well as I would now as I'm a little older. But then he went on to describe the racial dynamic yeah. on campus at University of Maryland, where it's a majority white school.
Women who wouldn't necessarily be interested in you as kind of a long-term relationship type of person. They're like, well, this big kind of like Mandingo strong black man, let's experiment with that and see what this is all about. Which obviously
we didn't. Were you aware of that at the time or looking back?
I think I was aware of it at the time, or I think I used it to justify some of the things that I would do, you know? So I wasn't like the best boyfriend or the best everything at the time. And I think I would use things like that. Like, well, they're just after me because they just want to be close to the football guy, or they just think that I'm in great shape and I'm like this stereotypical, like oversexed black male, and they want to give that a try, but they don't actually want to take me seriously. So, I mean, whatever. I don't care if like I am with her and her friend and don't think much about it, you know? So I think I was aware of it to the extent that it gave me cover, you know?
I remember I was on a flight to San Francisco in, like, I think it was June of last year when I, like, went back and listened to that episode. I remember where I was when he answered your question.
Wasn't it interesting?
Oh, my gosh.
I mean, it's like, because it's like, of course that's a dynamic that's happening.
Mm-hmm.
But you don't, I just had never heard someone say it out loud.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe that's because I'm a white person and, you know, black men aren't often talking to me about their love lives. but I think that it just like, it made, like, you know, it's easy to say like, oh, these, you know, athletes and rock stars and whomever are, you know, treating all these women like garbage because they can. But to see how the other side of that and the emotional dimension of feeling like you yourself are being used for whatever reason, because of your star power or because you're, you know, a in shape black man in college girls are interested in trying to be with you.
Mm-hmm.
I just thought it was like this really complicated dynamic, and it was an answer that I wasn't expecting, and I loved that moment.
Honestly, I'm a black woman. I date black men, and that answer surprised me. I had never heard anybody, like, it's something that I knew, but it's not anything that I had ever heard anybody put into words and then share in, I guess, what one would call mixed company. So
yeah.
I was, yeah, you know what I mean? I did not see that one.
I know. I mean, for me, it's made watching college sports so much more interesting. Because I'm just like, what is happening in all of your lives?
Yeah.
You know, if I could have a moment being a sideline reporter, like the questions I would ask.
Huh. So we've had our money clip, we've had our death clip, and so now we've arrived.
What we've been waiting for.
What we've been waiting for.
The crowd pleaser.
The crowd pleaser. The sex clip. So this clip comes to us from, actually, a sister show of yours, another WNYC podcast called Only Human.
Oh, good.
Which is hosted by Mary Harris. And in this episode, she interviews Max Ritvo, who is a 24-year-old writer from New York. And when he was a teenager, he was diagnosed with a rare and aggressive cancer. He had to get chemotherapy, but before he could start treatment, he had to take some precautions.
Cancer makes you sterile.
Right.
As comfortable as my
cancer or chemo makes you sterile?
Chemo makes you sterile, sorry. It's all one and the same. There's just one is the tails and one is the heads. So we decide to set some of my sperm aside so my wife can now realistically talk about babies with me. It was a good decision. But the harvestation of the sperm was very fraught because, you know, I'm sitting there in a hospital room. And my mom calls the sperm bank for me. She gets all the equipment, gives me a tube, and she looks at me and she says, you gotta do this. And then I guess call me when you're done. I'll be waiting outside. So she steps outside.
What are you thinking at this point?
I'm thinking this is the fucking weirdest thing that's ever happened to anyone. I am right now binding one of the most humiliating and strange moments with my child's DNA, with like what eventually will be calling me dad. And like whenever I look in this kid's eyes, I'm going to be remembering like the creaking sound of my hospital bed, you know, that I'm making matching with the beeping of my opium drip. You know, it was a very weird. Every teenage boy has some story about a time when usually it was their own impulse to masturbate led them into a weird situation. This was completely set upon me by the world, and it was very, very strange. So, and then I end up producing, and I go, Mom! And Mom is waiting outside, and I hear her, you know, she's Israeli, and she has a bit of an accent, which I can't do properly, but I think captures her gestalt. So my mom walks in, takes my sperm, and she sticks it into her little, like, lipstick pant pocket, like this really hip little lipstick pocket she has. And she goes, I was the first one to hold my grandchildren before even their mother.
Oh, and look at that mother considering the sperm the whole child.
So is that what you had in mind when we said we had a sex clip?
No, but I love that. I love that because I, you know, you think he's going to be like talking about just how odd it is to just, you know, the sperm, but the process that he goes the step further of thinking about that when he looks in his child's eyes, this is where it all began. Like that, it's just like really funny. Yeah,
I like that. Like, even though it's this really, I mean, it has to be such an incredibly scary and tragic time as a parent to see this person who you have raised, who you've created, and who, you know, you assume and you also really hope is going to outlive you by a lot, right? Yeah. To see them going through this really devastating time, but to still like find all of these ways to support and all of these ways to just be funny and bring like levity to the situation. That's like only your family can find a way to find a gentle and somehow appropriate way to humiliate you while you're like right before you start to go through chemotherapy.
I love that episode of Only Human. I really love that episode.
And I have one last question for you.
Mm-hmm.
Is there anything that you would like to know about me?
Yes. Oh, God, I should have seen this coming. Brittany. Okay, I'm going to ask you a money question.
Oh, my God.
But it's, I'm just curious. So it seems to my impression of your life.
Oh, God.
At this moment is you've had like a major, not only like did you make a major career shift, uh-huh. but you did it in a very public way where like you have an audience and feel kind of maybe exposed as you're like learning how to be the host of Sampler and what Sampler is. And
absolutely.
I understand the dynamics of that.
Yes, you do.
But what's it been like to, as you think about, the money angle I want to know about is like, you had a more conventional career path before you came to Gimlet.
Uh-huh.
Do you find yourself, do you feel more secure financially now? Or did you feel more secure then? And like, how do you weigh that against the like what it feels like now to have your creative work, the way you're making money?
I feel more financially secure now because, I mean, to be honest, I make more money now than I did at my previous job.
See, radio pays.
But I also have a lot more responsibility. The thing is, though, is so like the actual amount of money is not something that I think as much about. I think a lot more about, I guess, like so much of my livelihood before depended upon an organization, and like there's so many other people who are responsible for the product. Like the end product has very little to do with me. Well, had very little to do with me. Whereas now, the end product of everything that I make has a lot to do with me, and I feel a lot of pressure now that you mention it. I feel a lot of pressure to consistently deliver on myself, which is not something that I really had a concept of before and not something that I ever set out to make my living on, and to constantly be figuring out the best version of that I can give to people. So it's weird because my money now depends on me in this way that doesn't, like, not to say that I have a fantastic team. Like, I have so much support at Gimlet. It's not that. It's more so, like, people interact with what is essentially a product that has my face and name on it.
Mostly
and,
like, your voice.
Yeah, mostly my voice, exactly. But, like, that's weird, which is actually in my voice, which is scarier. It's, like, everything that I say. Like, that still feels very ephemeral to me. Even though I know it's not, I work with people who have had long careers doing exactly this. But, like, I had been doing other types of work consistently for what for me felt like a long time. So to then, like, do something completely different, that part feels actually scary. And that part sometimes wakes me up in the middle of the night.
But then you can just roll over and remember, but I just got a raise.
I will say, my sheets are nicer now.
Yes.
My sheets
good
are
investment.
Nicer now. Yes. God, how did you do that? You asked me a question and then I just started, like, waxing for minutes about, like, how I feel emotionally about the amount of money I make and where my livelihood comes from. And there you go. You just raised your eyebrows.
I just raised my eyebrows.
Well, Anna, thank you so much for coming.
Thank you.
So today you've heard real talk from Dan Savage on Anna Sales' WNYC show Death, Sex, and Money, and Joe Loya's first bank robbery from First Time, Last Time. Tim Gunn opened up about his adolescence on Fresh Air with Terry Gross from WHYY, and Max told us about harvesting sperm on WNYC's Only Human. Stay tuned after the credits for a taste of what we are sampling next week. This episode was produced by Rose Reed, Sarah Abderrahman, Matthew Nelson, and myself. It was edited by Annie Rose Strasser and Peter Clowney. Our theme music was made by Mike Avellian, and our ad music was made by Mark Phillips. Special thanks to Stevie Lane. The show is mixed by Matthew Bull. Sampler is a production of Gimlet Media. Next week on Sampler, I will face some fears.
She reaches inside the sneaker.
Oh my God, Sarah.
She finds a note.
Oh my God!